This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features a narration from the Essential Sasanko, a collection of chess portraits and personal stories authored by chess grandmaster Gena Sasanko. The subject of this week's story is Latvian international master Alvis Vidalins. Alvis was born in Riga, like his compatriot Miša Tal, and this was not all they shared in common. Like Tal, Vidalins was known for his brilliant sacrificial play. However, due to some personal hardships, he never reached the title of grandmaster. He also did not play many international tournaments. However, in Latvia, he shone, winning several championships. He was also known for his contributions to the poison pawn variation of the Sicilian, which was extremely popular during that time. Enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast.
Alvis Vidalins, 1946 to 1997. The Jump. "That will probably be Alvis," said Tal, hearing the bell and tearing himself away from the analysis to open the front door. "We agreed yesterday to play a few blitz games." The time was the summer of 1968. The place was Riga, Tal's flat, where I was helping him to prepare for his candidate's semi-final match with Korshnoi. Into the room came a very tall young man, leaning forward somewhat with a slightly rocking gait, a rather sullen appearance with a high-retreating forehead and a vacant stare directed somewhere into space. It was Alvis Vidalins. We were already acquainted. Several years earlier at some tournament in Leningrad, we had played a game. In an initially equal ending with opposite-coloured bishops, Vidalins had developed a strong initiative, and it appeared that things would turn out badly for me. In addition, I was short of time and I grew very nervous. At this point, Vidalins offered a draw. He did not want to play on my time trouble. After stopping the clocks, he began demonstrating some far-from-obvious variations where black would hold the position. That day, Tal and Vidalins played blitz until late in the evening, as occurred on other days too. Tal, one of the greatest experts of his time at lightning play, won more frequently, of course, but often, normally with white, Alvis would succeed with brilliant attacks, the outlines of which I still recall. It was then that I really understood what the superb tactician Tal had in mind when, in analysis, he would sacrifice material for the initiative and become animated. "Well now, let's play like Vidalins!" Alvis Vidalins was born on June 15, 1946, in Sigulda, in the environs of Riga. The boy was 9 years old when his father took him to his first trainer, Felix Sertsensis. Vidalins' talent was obvious, and within a few years he was to become one of the strongest juniors in the USSR. "He was the best of us," recalls Yuri Razuvayev. Alvis always shone in the All-Union Junior competitions. It was no accident that he was also one of the first to become a master. Already then, Vidalins had a very subtle sense of equilibrium in chess. When it was disturbed, a piece initiative in his hands became a decisive factor. He was very tall, and we gave him the nickname Dlini, brackets, lanky, close brackets. There was something special in Alvis, the kind of biological phenomenon of a winner, of a person who had a different perception of chess. It is probable that something similar was felt by the opponents of Fischer, to whom, incidentally, he was similar in his entire appearance. But even then, it was already apparent that he was naive, unusual, and absorbed in himself. A typical scene of those years, at a junior training session, Vidalins, the chess hope of Latvia, is having a fight with Vuorema, the Estonian player. One can imagine what kind of feelings they experienced towards Russia and the Soviet Union. The physically stronger Vidalins pins his opponent to the bed with a pillow, and the loser begs for mercy. The demand of the winner, "You will sing the national anthem of the Soviet Union in Russian." Vladimir Tukmakov calls the chess potential that Vidalins had fantastic. Because of his sharp, vivid, combinative style, Vidalins was called the second Tal. For him, chess was everything, which also made him similar to Tal. He was uncommunicative, as though all wrapped up in himself. Although I played him several times, I doubt whether we exchanged more than a sentence or two after the game. The great hopes extended to him were not realised. It became clear that he would not become a great player, and this happened before he was 30. He quickly burned out.
Of course, even after this, everyone knew that Vitellins was very dangerous and that you could not relax against him, but his time had already passed.
Indeed, Vitellin's entire biography can be summed up in a few lines. Initially, there were enormous hopes and successes in junior competitions, successes which somehow came to nothing. He did not even become a grandmaster, and the number of international tournaments that he played, all within the Soviet Union, can be counted on the fingers of one hand. In Latvia, however, Alvis shone. 7 times he won the Championship of the Republic, and several times he won Baltic tournaments, and that, really, is all. In the late 80s and early 90s, when it finally became possible to travel abroad, he played in some open tournaments in Germany, but he was already in his 40s and his best years were obviously behind him. He completed 2 courses at the German department of the University Philological Faculty in Riga, and he spoke German quite well. All his life, Vitellins lived with his parents, and he was never married. These are the external contours of his biography. The fact is that he had no other life apart from that associated with games, tournaments, and endless analyses. How did he play? Vitellins's motto was the initiative at any price. The creation of positions where 2 pawns, or even 1 pawn for a piece, are sufficient compensation, because the pieces remaining on the board develop a furious energy. This becomes the decisive factor in the evaluation of the position, more even than the vulnerability of the enemy king. Very often, after such a sacrifice, amazing things would happen. The positional advantage would inexorably increase, the opponent's superior forces would lose their coordination, and the attack would strengthen with every move. It stands to reason that the king remained his target, but the main aim was nevertheless to extract the maximum energy from the pieces. Such a manner of play is altogether typical of the Latvian school of chess. Obvious in Tal and Vitellins, it can be observed today in Shirov, Shabalov and Lanka. A distinguishing feature of this style is the creation of positions where both kings are under threat, everything is hanging, and from one incorrect move, the entire construction can collapse. It is for good reason that Shirov's book is entitled Fire on Board. Like Shirov, Vitellins possessed good endgame technique, but he played hardly any lengthy manoeuvring games. If, in Napoleon's definition of war as a simple art consisting entirely in action, we replace war with chess, we come close to Vitellins's perception of the game. In the chess world, people knew that if Alvis obtained his kind of position, he would win against anyone. But however striking Vitellins was as a player, in the first instance, he was a tireless researcher of chess. His motto was 1, e2 to e4, and wins! He followed the line of Vsevolod Rauser, that remarkable researcher with whose name is associated the development of many attacking systems in the theory of the game. Or, perhaps, the roots are even deeper, in the convictions of Philidor, who asserted that the player beginning the game should win with correct play. In all the openings he analysed for White, Vitellins tried to demonstrate not only an advantage, but a big advantage, if possible, a decisive one. In the words of Vladimir Bagirov, "Starting in 1980, when I began holding training sessions with the Latvian team, Alvin came to me every Friday. Our lessons consisted in us playing blitz 5-minute. The winner was the first who gained 10 points. Vitellins played every game as if it were the game of his life, and he suffered terribly when he lost. He was a brilliant blitz player, in some way not inferior even to Tal. I sometimes beat him, but he won more often and by a bigger margin. In all the games where I was black, we played the Aliakin defence or the Karakhan. He prepared for these matches thoroughly, and he developed his own ideas, trying to obtain a big advantage in the Karakhan, and altogether to refute the Aliakin defence, which he did not consider a serious opening. The storming continuation on the 6th move, which he employed most often and subsequently introduced into tournament play, I called the Vitellins variation in my book."
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators.
With the DGT electronic chessboard, millions of chess lovers can follow chess tournaments live. At-home chess fans use the boards to play online or play against chess computers with the same boards that top players use in tournaments all over the world. Play like a pro with a DGT board.
Vitalins developed and created the modern theory of the Cochrane Gambit in the Petrov defence and played dozens of games with this variation. "Will you sacrifice on f7 if I play the Petrov?" Vitalins was asked by one of the participants in the 1985 Latvian Championship, who had prepared what he considered to be an improvement. "Of course," came the confident reply. He won in a swift, crushing attack. However, the main testing ground of his searchings was the Sicilian defence, where he was a veritable generator of ideas. The favourite squares for his bishops in this opening were b5 and g5. Very often he dropped the bishop on b5, even if this square was controlled by a pawn on a6. He would develop his position in a fan shape, often directing his knights to the squares d5, f5 and e6, where they were under attack of the enemy pawns. He was responsible for numerous discoveries in the poisoned pawn variation, which was very popular in the 60s and 70s, and which was regularly employed by Fischer. Essentially, the entire theory of the major branch of this variation, involving a knight sacrifice on the 18th move and an attack with subsequent quiet moves, began with Vitalins. About another branch of the same variation, which he introduced into tournament play, he wrote an article for New in Chess, concluding it with the characteristic words, "My experience as a chess analyst tells me that any, even the most thorough analysis, may have certain flaws. I just want to point out to the reader that even in a seemingly worn-out variation, completely new ideas can be found. Truly, chess has no limits." Vitalins was also responsible for several of the most aggressive continuations against the Polugievsky variation. Tal, who on many occasions made use of Alvis's help and advice, successfully employed these ideas in a match against the author of the variation himself, although he did not succeed in realising them to the end. However, another idea of Vitalins in the Rauser variation, brackets, again the bold development of the bishop at b5, close brackets, brought Tal some important points. First, in the interzonal tournament, and then in the candidates tournament, in a game against Korshnoi in Montpellier, 1985. Misha, in general, regarded Vitalins very touchingly, seeing in him an unfulfilled genius, which, of course, he was. He always spoke of him as a like thinker and successor. Vitalins was responsible for the idea of the pawn sacrifice, b7 to b5, in the 4 queen c2 variation of the Nimzo Indian defence, and the variation with bishop b4 check followed by c7 to c5 in the Bogo Indian defence was one that he first began to develop. At first sight, the latter idea looks absurd. A pawn, with which the centre could have been attacked, voluntarily moves to the flank. On the other hand, tension is created on that part of the board, and, most important, an unusual position is reached where his rich imagination could display itself. In the old days, there was a simple attitude to the problem of improvement in chess. There are no particular subtleties in this game. If you are not aiming to become a professional player, you should only play as often as possible, wrote Schiffers in the Shakhmatny Journal in 1894. However, in modern chess systematic training, the study of special literature and analysis became essential for raising the standard of play. Although in chess, genuine diligence consists not so much in working zealously as in working correctly, a truth which is often forgotten by amateurs trying to make progress in the game and not sparing time on improvement. But what is meant by chess analysis, and how did Vitalins analyse? It is obvious that he was constantly in a state that is well known to anyone who has seriously studied chess. After several hours of evening analysis, a position appears to be resolved, but a final verdict has not yet been reached at. It is somewhere close, but it slips away elusively. Night comes, you feel tired,
and he realized that it would be best to put things off until tomorrow. But in desperation, you continue seeking this tempo, and you check all the moves approaching the start of the variation, and sometimes even the initial placing of the pieces. But if the truth dawns and the solution is finally found, you know that the joy of discovery will outweigh the fatigue of all the days, weeks, and even months spent searching for that which you intuitively sensed from the very start. In his case, time played altogether no role, and the reward was not prizes, money, or rating points, but the process itself of immersion in chess. Chess theory is like a snake, which grows and sheds its skin. A continuous renewal is taking place. But in contrast to a snake, in the theory of chess, there is an ongoing process of returning to old variations that have gone out of fashion. They appear enriched with new ideas. Many notches on this line of research were made by Alvis Vitelins. His ideas left their mark. Even if much of what he analysed or played now seems naive, or, after testing by time and computer, not altogether correct. He was overflowing with ideas, and when playing, he was not always able to make a realistic evaluation of the situation on the board. This, along with his open dislike for defence and play in slightly inferior positions, was his obvious weakness. Lev Albert and Yuri Razuviev, who played Vitelins many times, recall how they tried to play against him in classical style, with exaggerated strictness, knowing that at some point Alvis might be carried away by some spectacular move or some brilliant, tempting but not altogether correct combination, and would let the game slip out of control. However, to understand fully the phenomenon of Alvis Vitelins, one has to know that he suffered from a severe mental derangement. Effectively from the very start, he was not so much battling against his opponent as against himself. Sigurd Slanke knew Vitelins from the mid-70s, when he himself began playing regularly in the Latvian championships. Alvis's junior trainer, Cesenis, thought that already towards the end of his school days, he was beginning to display symptoms of schizophrenia. This illness pursued Vitelins throughout his life. All the time he had to take strong drugs, which dulled his perception and made him play worse. He used to avoid taking them in order to retain clarity of thought and reaction, but this led to breakdowns. At the board this displayed itself when, in a perfectly normal, perfectly defensible position, he would simply resign if it was not to his liking. In life, being a willful and direct person, he could even knock somebody out. Not everyone was able to endure his daily regime. Since I was the youngest in the team, in all competitions outside Riga, we were always put in the same hotel room. At night, he would usually be awake, analysing some position on a magnetic chess set, dropping off to sleep only towards morning. He might not get to bed for 2 days, but then he would sleep for a whole 24 hours. He could almost always be found in the Riga Chess Club. He would be there for days on end. I played a mass of games with him, tournament games with a shortened time control or blitz. When playing black, I felt, as perhaps against no one else, that I was constantly under terrible pressure. Each move of his created some threat and carried a definite charge of energy. He would not allow me to play quietly. His play was a demonstration of colossal dynamics and excellent technique, based on classical, logical chess and good training. When I now see how Shirov analyses, or when I play through the games of Anand and Kramnik, I am reminded of Alvis. Absolute penetration into the essence of the position and anticipation of events many moves ahead. This comes easily to very few.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.